Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 32 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I'm delighted to have Lynn Jackson, a descendant of Dred Scott and president of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. All right, well, welcome, Lynn Jackson, to Conversations with Kenyatta. I'm very excited to have you here today, especially being an attorney and a constitutional law sort of nerd. I'm excited to have a discussion with you about your background and your famous relative. So let's start with, tell me a little bit about your childhood and your background.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate being on your podcast today. It's an honor to have met you. And I'm happy for the work that you're doing. So my background is that I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. My family are direct descendants of Dred Scott. He is my great-great-grandfather through my father's side. My dad was Dr. John A. Madison, and he was the family historian because he was the sixth of seven children and got his law degree at Lincoln University. I don't have my law degree, but I spent 13 years at Bryan Cave Law Firm, for which I am eternally grateful. And they were there when I started the foundation. So, you know, we do have an interest in law, but and I don't even know if it's because of our ancestor. But growing up, I would hear about Dred Scott, but not as much as people might think, because there was, we live in St. Louis, and there is a place called The Ville. It was a very affluent Black neighborhood, you know, with redlining and everything. This is where some people settled. I was born in The Ville. But my dad shortly thereafter moved across the red line. I went to an all-Black kindergarten low to an all-white kindergarten high. And so I really know that had I stayed where I was or because of where I moved, we got an exceptional education. So I've just always been interested in learning everything. I found out that my great-great-grandfather was a very important person when there was this big celebration of one of his anniversaries at the old courthouse in St. Louis. My father played Dred Scott that night, but he never spoke. And I always tell people my dad was very, very articulate. So for him not to speak, even at the small age of 3 or 4, I was thinking, how come daddy's not talking? This is like not like him. I had no clue, of course, that slaves couldn't speak. So even though he portrayed Dred Scott at a trial, there was no conversation from him. And it just went on from there. So I graduated from SIU Edwardsville in Edwardsville, Illinois. And I got my background degree in business administration and marketing. I've had a wonderful career. I ended up at Bryan Cave. And in 2007, I should say leading up to 2007, I felt like that 150th anniversary of the decision shouldn't go by without the family's participation. So that's when I got the idea in 2003, 4, and 5 that maybe I should do something. That something turned out to be the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. And I based it on 3 things. They came directly from the man upstairs. And I said commemoration, education, and reconciliation. I had no idea what reconciliation was going to look like or what I was supposed to do. The other two were no-brainers. But I said, okay. And everything has taken off since then. It's been an incredible journey.
And with that, let's, and thank you for that kind of comprehensive, you know, background and sort of leading us down the path to the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. But for those who don't know, who are listening in the audience, can you kind of just give a brief overview of Dred Scott, his importance and the case that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Dred Scott was born in Southampton, Virginia, around 1799. We don't know his exact date of birth, of course, but he was born to the Blow family. Peter Blow and Elizabeth Blow had 11 children. At the time, he had 800 acres of tobacco farm, but he moved his family westward through Alabama for some years and ended up in St. Louis in 1830, at which time he tried businesses. They failed. He had to sell some things. He sold Dred Scott to an army surgeon who eventually took him to many places, including Fort Snelling in Minnesota, which was the Wisconsin territories. That was free territory. And in 1840, they came back to St. Louis. Dr. Emerson died in 1843, leaving Dred and his now wife, Harriet, and new daughter, and brand new daughter, 8 years apart, were Eliza and Liz. He brought his family back. When the doctor died, he asked for his freedom. Mrs. Emerson said no. He asked to buy his freedom for $300 at the time, plus securities. She said no. And it left him no recourse but to sue, because Missouri had a law that said once free, always free. If you lived in free territory or had residence for any amount of time, it didn't have to be that long, you could be free, declare your freedom. They came back to Missouri, however, and that was not recognized. So the short of it is that Dred, along with his wife Harriet, who also filed her own separate suit. A lot of people don't know that. There were two cases going through the courts. The both of them on April the 6th, 1846, started a case that would last until March 6th of 1857. At that point, it had gone through five proceedings, 11 years, to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, where Justice Roger B. Taney, the Chief Justice, read what they called the majority opinion, although every of the nine justices wrote their own opinion, very unique. He read that blacks had no rights, that whites were bound to respect, and that Dred Scott and all descendants of African Americans, or anyone from Africa, would never be citizens. Because he was not a citizen, therefore, he had no standing. This case was, after 11 years, thrown out of court, and Dred Scott was remanded back to slavery. However, on the brighter side, the Blow family, those 11 children, several of them helped Dred and Harriet all those years in many ways to help secure attorneys, to pay bills, whatever they needed, whatever they could do. And in the very end, and this is quite the thumbnail, but in the very, very end of it, it was Taylor Blow, the 10th of the 11 children, who bought two $1,000 bonds, one for Dred, one for Harriet, covered the girls, and bought their freedom. He was able to do that because he bought them back from Mrs. Emerson, and with the express purpose of freeing them. So Dred and his family were freed on May 26th of 1857. But in the meantime, the Dred Scott decision had embroiled this nation in an even higher fervor of animosity and separation and this anger over the whole issue of slavery. So Dred Scott decision of March 6, 1857 was a major catalyst to the Civil War. And as you know, the Civil War was fought between 1861 and 1865. In fact, Dred Scott's case was one of the main reasons Abraham Lincoln did not get out of politics, but stayed. And he really did an about face because of this and became our 14th president. The 16th president, I believe, and went through that process to win the war. It was very important about the outcome of the war because the 13th Amendment ended slavery. The 14th Amendment gave citizenship to everyone who was born here or naturalized, so that included all the slaves. And then the 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote. And those were also sometimes called the Dred Scott Amendments. So his case is the most well-known, most important civil rights case as far as citizenship goes. And all lawyers, like yourself, had to study it to get through law school, and it's still a requirement today.
Yeah, thank you for all that background. One of the things I wanted to clarify, if I got this right, is that so Taylor Blow, the 10th of the 11th child, of the Blow family, was able to help get the bonds for Harriet and for Dred Scott. But if I am correct, the Dred Scott was originally enslaved by the Blow family. Is that correct?
Yes, you know, I'm trying to be brief here, but let me tell you this little part because it is important. And I did not dig into it, but I'll say this quickly. Mrs. Emerson left St. Louis, left her business, her slaves, under the care of her brother, John Sanford, which is why it's Dred Scott v. Sanford. But she went to Boston and looking for a new husband. Now she was a widow with a daughter, and she married a congressman and a dentist named Dr. Calvin Chafee. Dr. Chafee was a well-known, well-respected, and very ardent abolitionist. And she just forgot to tell him that she owned any slaves. And as the case proceeded throughout the court and the nation was embroiling more and more in this conversation, it came out and he read it in the newspaper that his wife and therefore he owned these famous slaves. He would have none of it and set in motion to see how he could free this family. And in order to do that, the attorney in St. Louis was Roswell Field. The attorney in Washington was Montgomery Blair. And then the three of them, Dr. Chafee included, came up with a plan that Dred Scott approved and asked for Taylor Blow, because you know he grew up with them and they stuck with him. So his whole life, these were almost like his friends. The children, this is important, were never slave owners. The children were themselves abolitionists. And so that is why Taylor Blow was able to free them, because he bought them for $1 with the express purpose of freeing them.
So that's interesting. And that I appreciate that backstory because even studying the case, right, I didn't know all the details.
Most people didn't know these details until recently. It was out there, but we've been able to pull it together.
Well, that's great, because then it paints a picture. I think when I think about doing genealogy research, especially slave genealogy research, and establishing the connection between the enslaved and the enslaver, and now you're talking about a family here, the Blow family, whose the children are abolitionist. Now Mrs. Emerson, in going to Boston to find her new husband to take care of her and her child, marries an abolitionist who then gets together with the attorneys, the attorney, and then the Blow family, and they all have this plan to free Dred and Harriet Scott. To free the family. So to me, that's interesting, because you don't really hear those stories. A lot of times, those are things that, as a descendant, something you would either hear through oral history, as you said, or you guys have discovered, it's been discovered recently, and that part of the story hasn't been told. So I think it's very important to share that with the audience. And are there any other kind of things you think that are important, little things that happen, not little things, but pieces of sort of the puzzle that helped in freeing them or that helped their case along the way that we may not know?
Yes. This is kind of fun fact for me, because I've been wanting to figure this little mystery out. As the cases were proceeding through the courts, Dred and Harriet made a decision to hide their daughters so that they would not get sold out from under them. Keeping in mind that Mrs. Emerson went to Boston. And so who's watching Dred and Harriet? Nobody ever asked me that, which is interesting. But I do share that they were under the jurisdiction of the local sheriff in town, Sheriff LeBaum. And LeBaum family were obviously sympathetic to the Scots. And so that was actually a good thing for them. But they would hire themselves out, and all the money that they would earn would go in escrow, depending on who won the case. But in the meantime, since they had a little bit of autonomy there, but the girls, in order for them not to get snatched, and there was a woman not far from the courthouse that they say did buy young girls in order to sell them. That was her business, I guess, that they hid those two girls. Eliza and Lizzie were 8 years apart, and no one knows where they were hidden. However, I have recently stumbled upon a clue that I put together, and I really feel, Kenyatta, that I may know where they were hidden. And it's really exciting to me, but I need to vet it a little more. I don't know if I'll ever be able to say for sure, but this really will open up some additional aspects of the story, because this was truly vetted in the Frank Leslie Illustrated, because in the issue of June 27, 1857, 3 months after they were freed after the case. Dwed is interviewed, and the interview states from his own words that his girls were hidden away, but he could call them back at any time if he so chose to. So we know that they were in St. Louis and not far from their family, although they were well hidden. So that's one thing. The aspect of the young girls, how this affected their lives. The youngest daughter was Lizzie, and she was born in 1846, just a few weeks before they filed for their case. I have researched that and figured out that she had to be born between January and March 6th. So as it turns out, though, the first 11 years of her life, from day one almost, was the Dred Scott case and being hidden away, knowing that this fervor was going on in the nation. As she got older, she'd be about 10 or 11 years old. And so she obviously, even when you look at her picture, she looks frightened. Her sister has her arm around her to comfort her, but there's the only pictures we have of them show her, and she has a little worried look on her face. But she lived to be 99 years old, almost, again, 2 months shy of 100. So we know this because she literally took care of my grandmother's children, which includes my father and his sister, who were the sixth and seventh of my grandmother's seven children. My grandmother was married to Dred Scott's grandson. So my dad knew the daughter of Dred Scott until he was about 20 years old. And my aunt was babysat by her 5 days a week until she went to kindergarten. So they never told us that, though. I found this out just doing my genealogy research like you do. And we did an interview with my aunt. And there's this wonderful book called Dred and Harriet Scott, Their Family Story, that details so much. There's one more aspect that we didn't know. We thought that my grandfather, John, and his brother Harry were the only two children they had. And in doing the genealogy, we found out there were four more children, all of whom died at infancy or birth or very close to it. And that two of those babies were interred, one with Dred and one with Harriet. So for all these years, we never knew that they have a grandchild in their grave with them.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a shocker. And, you know, people did that, but we're not really aware of that in this day and age, that might have happened. It didn't happen all the time, but it did happen.
So do you think, a question about kind of you found out and you knew your relationship to Dred Scott, and when you were younger and you talked about mentioned your father with the big celebration and him playing Dred Scott. But as you're talking and telling me kind of the stories you uncovered in your research, it seems as though you had or may have hit what most genealogists, I feel, especially African-American history or in genealogy, hit is this kind of point where sometimes the elders in the family or the older people in the family do not want to share information. And so I would think with something like this, something so famous, so impactful to American history, to the nation at such a tumultuous time, that it would be shared. And those stories about, you know, Eliza and taking care of, you know, your father and your aunt, that those things would be shared. Why do you think that information wasn't given to you when you were younger?
Well, very much I've thought about that, and it's pretty clear to me that, first of all, let's go back and talk about Lizzie for a minute. The first 11 years of her life, she was in a state of fear and being hidden away, separated from her parents. So this whole thing about her dad and her mother, it marked her life. So that, for her, is a reason why she even changed her last name. And I knew what it was, but hardly anybody else did. And because I knew what it was a key that opened up so much to our research. The parents, grandparents, and I was with my aunt and grandmother a lot. We went to church, and I was the Sunday school superintendent. I took over for my aunt, who was the Sunday school superintendent. I took her home. We were always at family. Nobody ever said a word. Not a word. My daddy never said it. And I know that it was because my grandmother's born in 1890. And her oldest child was born in 1916, 14, 16, and 18 were first three children. It was too close. it was dangerous. We had Jim Crow, we had lynchings, there was a Klan. Who wants to stand up and say, oh, and by the way, my grandfather is the one who ended slavery. So aren't we happy about that? Well, sure we are, but everybody else might not have been. And so seriously, it was a matter of safety. We're not discussing that. But like you said, this is common in a lot of African-American families that the elders do not talk about it. The other reason I believe, and I know this was true in our family, it's like, okay, we know this history, but we don't want to pass this trauma on to our children. So our emphasis was education. My dad got his doctorate in law and his master's in education. My mother was a nurse. I was the first child. I did get my degree. But the thing is, I think families wanted their children to have a clear mind and move forward and make it. That seems to be what I've noticed in my family's friends. Mm-hmm. You know, your parents have friends and they're like your aunt and uncles and they're all doing their thing. It was very much like, you know, we know what happened and we're going to tell you some of this, but we want you to get a good emotional and mental attitude and an education before we dump all this on you.
Right. I mean, it makes sense of that generational trauma. I mean, we talked about that before, and I know we've talked about it on a podcast, and I have that conversation with other folks all the time. And I understand that. You want the child to, or grandchild to, have a clear head, to be able to feel like they can accomplish something, move forward. And education was a way to do that. And that was something that was also pushed in my family as well, at least my mom. But I want to get back to Lizzie. I think you said that Lizzie changed her last name, but you were still able to find her. What was, once she changed her name, did she stay in St. Louis? What was her life like after that?
Well, now you're asking one of my favorite questions, what was her life like? But let me see about all of what you just said. Okay, she did stay in St. Louis. And like I said, she helped raise the younger children. As far as I know, she never moved away. But she also changed her last name, which was something that my aunt Alma told me. And I want to give credit, by the way, to Ruth Ann Hager, who was the certified genealogist at the St. Louis County Library. And I met her through her doing a small little pamphlet on Harriet for a talk she was going to give in Virginia, I believe, in 2006. And Ruth Ann Hager did a lot of this research, and we just kind of got to be very good friends, and we worked together on this. And she had called me about, there's all these Harriets and Elizabeths out there, and I'm stumped. I just can't find the right Harriet for my little pamphlet. And because I don't remember if someone told me that she was going to call, but I just had a very good feeling about her. And I felt like this was somebody I could tell about Lizzie's name. So I shared with her that her last name was Marshall. And I knew the oral history from my aunt about where she lived, the severity of her person, that she was extremely old. Of course, all children think anybody over 20 is old, but she was right. She was very, very old. And yet all of this oral history matched the death certificate that I was able to find through another friend at Bryan Cave, and shared it with Ruth Ann. All of the oral history matched the death certificate, and we were able to say that this was Dred Scott's daughter. And so that was important. Now, her life, what was it like? This is the part I don't often get to share, but her sister had these six children, but she died relatively young, around 40, in her 40s or right at 40. So she didn't have the same life that her younger sister had. Lizzie was born day one at the onset of the Dred Scott case. She lived 11 years and was hidden away from her family during possibly up to 2 years of that time. Her father lost his case. A war ensued. She lived through that. She lost her father, by the way, the very next year. After the war, she saw the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and the aftermath of all of that. She lived through the era where Blacks were actually going to rise to some prominence. You know, we had Black senators and statesmen and so forth. But then she lived through Jim Crow, and she lived through World War I, and then she lived through the Klan. She lived through the rise of Hitler, and she embarked right at World War II. So she had a lot of years to see a lot of change. You know, she saw the automobile from horses to cars, and yet she was secluded. She secluded herself. The drapes were thick and dark and tall. She wore dark, severe clothes as she would walk my aunt from her house to the bus stop and back home on Sundays. On Fridays, so she could go back home and be with family over the weekend, and then they would go back. And she probably didn't smile a lot, I don't think. But she was steadfast, and she was there for her family. I'm sure she was a great disciplinarian. She took care of the two boys when my grandfather and his brother, John and Harry, she took care of them. And then she took care of John's children when he passed. And my grandfather died on May the 1st of 1931. And he, like Dred, I believe, Dred and Harriet and my grandmother Grace Cross Madison and John Madison, both sets of couples may have been about 20 years apart in age. We have a theory about my grandfather. We don't know exactly when he was born, but Ruth Ann came up with the fact that he might have been a little older than he told Grace so that she would marry him. And so the families were very close, and we've always stayed very close. But she had quite a life.
Well, it seems like it. And I want to, just for the listeners, make just a point of clarification on my part. I believe I said Eliza instead of Lizzie. So Lizzie was the one who took care of the children and, you know, never moved away. And you just told her story and changed her name. But Eliza was the daughter that died relatively young. Is that correct?
Yes. And since you brought that up, I will share this too. Another fun fact that we found when Ruth Ann was doing this research, the family had always said that Lizzie married Wilson Madison and that she was our great grandmother. And until 2006, that was the story. My father did tell me that he and his sister always felt that even though she would say, "Call me Aunt Lizzie, just call me Aunt Lizzie," they always thought that that was their grandmother. They believed it. So we lived forever, and they, except Aunt Elma and my father, pretty much, you know, lived all their lives believing that Lizzie was their grandmother. And she just said, "Call me Aunt Lizzie," because, you know, we kind of knew she was trying to like stay behind the scenes. But this research shows us that Eliza was our great grandmother, and Lizzie really was Aunt Lizzie. But you know, I mean, everybody was playing a role at the time, or however they wanted to be seen or not seen. And yet it was their impression of her. And that makes me think that she must have been kind to them. And at some point, they got the feeling that this was a grandma. Now, not all grandmothers are kind. We know that. But for some reason, they thought she was. And so as it turns out, she told the truth. But we would not have known that if we hadn't had the opportunity to do this kind of genealogy we can do today. And we wouldn't know about those other children.
Well, that's great. I mean, I love the background story, right? Because, you know, it's important to know the story of Dred and Harriet Scott and their family, but also just to understand kind of, you know, you're kind of pulling back the curtain, so to speak, to what went on as the impact, right, to the next generation. And I wrote down everything that Lizzie lived through as you were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, especially now, I think with people thinking about us living through COVID, through, you know, 2020 with George Floyd and political divisions and all this other stuff that we're going through now, I just look at that list of things that one person went through, starting her life out basically with this sort of trauma and chaos, and watching it go, you know, until her death, and living and surviving all of that. And it's not surprising that she really had the curtains drawn, that she, you know, secluded herself and wore dark clothes because she lived through a period of trauma and started her life out in that way, I think.
That's true. And along with that, when her father died, you know, a lot of people don't know this either, but he was buried at Westland Cemetery, which is where St. Louis University stands now at Grand and Laclede. But he was moved because there was the impending removal of that cemetery. And Taylor Blow, once again, spent money to move him to Calvary Cemetery, which is a beautiful, large, huge Catholic cemetery here in St. Louis. Now, as it turns out, when he moved him, there was an unmarked grave at Wesleyan, and then there continued to be an unmarked grave at Calvary until 1957. So for 90 years, from 1867 to 1957, he was unmarked at Calvary. Part of that, of course, was the fact that there had been threats to, you know, desecrate him. So being that he was unmarked, you know, this eliminated that possibility. And yet in 1957, he got his first headstone. And we'll talk about that a little more shortly.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great time to do that because I want to make sure we cover that piece and also get into the foundation work that you're doing, because I think that's also important in some ways in which maybe, you know, other folks can get involved or some of the things you guys have coming up as it relates to the foundation. But let's talk about 1957 and finally getting a headstone. What did that mean and how did that happen?
In 1954 and in 1957, our family was in Ebony Magazine. And primarily, people think about the one in 1957 because it was the 100th anniversary of the decision. And as it turns out, one of my uncle's names was Dred Scott Madison. And so all the family was here, and my father and my uncle, you know, pretty much were spokespersons for the family. And there was a wreath laid at that spot, but there was this Jesuit priest named Father Edward Dowling, who had gone through records in the cemetery basement and found that Dred Scott was buried in Section 1, Lot 177. And it wasn't known where he was buried, so he felt that he had found a great find, which he did. As it turns out, the story has always been in Ebony Magazine of 57, you have a picture of Father Dowling pointing his cane at Dred Scott's spot. And my mom and dad and brother and I, very, very young children, are standing there listening to him share with us. And so the story had come down until just recently that he had found his grave and was showing the family where he was buried. But if you go back to the Ebony Magazine of 1954, you see my father and my uncle laying a wreath also at the spot for Dred Scott. And it would indicate that the family knew where he was buried. And so it wasn't so much that Father Dowling was telling us where he was buried, but showing us this is where he's buried. And then he went on to say that we would like to have a headstone marker here. He raised money, or he attempted to raise money for it. But as it turns out, and I've seen the letters of correspondence as to all of how this happened, even to my parents, to a descendant of the Blow family. And Mrs. Charles Harrison, granddaughter of Taylor Blow, offered and did pay for the headstone that is today at Calvary Cemetery. So she was from Pennsylvania, and she did come down for the event. There is a picture of her, and we're having a hard time finding it, but I can see it in my mind's eye because I remember seeing that photograph of her. And so a member of the Blow family actually bought the headstone for Dred Scott, the first one he ever had. And it was 28 inches high, 24 inches wide. And Father Dowling said that this is but a modest headstone. And if anyone ever wants to ever do more, they at least know where he is buried. So fast forward to COVID 2020. And I had always thought to myself, this is wonderful. I'm so happy that the Blow family participated and we have this marker, but it's so small and I could hardly find it. There are days, if I hadn't made my own map, I would never be able to find it. It's hard to find and it's small, but the decision to go ahead with the vision of getting him a larger headstone became a reality in 2020 because we couldn't do anything for the foundation. No one could do anything. So I said, well, this is a great time to kickstart this. So we did start a GoFundMe. As it turns out, we have received a grant from the Mellon Foundation. And I designed a headstone, which is now going to be a memorial monument. And listen to this part. Dred Scott is buried in a plot that has three grave sites on it. At the cemetery, there was a rule that a Black person could not be buried next to a white person. So Taylor Blow bought three plots so that there would be two empty plots on either side of Dred. And even though that was an unfortunate and sad thing to have to come by in that time, to say today we have those three lots and we are going to build, which by the way is in progress, a 10-foot by 10-foot granite base with a 9-foot high granite platform. Well, I guess you would say monument. We'll just call it a monument until you can see what it looks like. And we'll be able to have inscriptions and tell the story of Dred Scott decision, etc. And so we're very excited about it. And it's going to be simply gorgeous. And I cannot wait. But that is going to be one of our upcoming projects. I don't want to skip something, Kenyatta, because we fast forwarded to that. But in 2012, we also raised $250,000 to put the first and only statue of Dred Scott up at the old courthouse. And it includes his wife, Harriet. And you all can find that on the internet. It's out there everywhere. And it was created by Harry Weber. And he's a master sculptor here. He does so many famous people, including our St. Louis Cardinals. But Harry did a beautiful job on showing the love and the closeness of Dred and Harriet as they did this thing together. And so that was our first great achievement, was to get that installed on June the 8th of 2012. And we've done many things since then. The foundation was based on, again, commemoration, education, and reconciliation. But that was commemoration. And this also will be, we have a lot of reconciliation issues that we have been able to walk into and do some great work with. But that statue and this monument will be two things that didn't exist before that will endure and help future generations understand better and see for themselves who Dred Scott was and why this case was important.
Well, thank you for sharing that, especially going back to 2012. One of the things that, as you were talking about this, I kind of had so many thoughts going through my mind as a genealogist, especially to the folks listening that are researching their own families. I have individuals in my family who are buried with unmarked graves, I believe my third great grandparents in upstate New York. I know the general area. And of course, times you think about, you know, buying a headstone, figuring it out, making sure it's the right place, you know, the right person, it's your ancestor. Mm-hmm. And not everyone can do that. But I do feel inspired from your story and just seeing that it's something that, even if it's something that starts out small, at least it's honoring them, and then you could build upon that. And you don't necessarily have to be the descendant of someone whose court case changed the course of history in America. You can
absolutely
do that
not.
Yeah, with your own ancestors.
And they should.
Yeah, and they should. And that's the thing. I was thinking in my head, okay, I need to go back when I have time and look at the cemetery in Leroy, New York, to see, to kind of figure out again where they're buried and what I can do to honor them, because I think that's so important, because they're part of history as well. And I want their story to outlast me and for future generations.
Exactly.
And I hope others are inspired as well by that. Just in
listening. I surely hope so, because I just, you know, one thing leads to another, but you remind me too to share that on June 20th, this year, 2022, I was very honored to be among the few people who got to speak at the dedication and unveiling of the first Freedom Suits Memorial. I don't know where there is another one, but we have a Freedom Suits Memorial here in St. Louis to honor between 300 and 400 people who sued for their freedom here in the city, whose records were found several years ago, around 2003, I believe. And Judge David Mason had this vision of doing this. And so, again, you can search for that and find St. Louis Freedom Suits Memorial. And it was unveiled in front of the Civic Courts building, a different courthouse from Dred Scott. It's on the front lawn, which was renamed Freedom Plaza. So Freedom Plaza has this towering monument about 14 feet high it is off the base, inclusive. And so that was a great moment here just a couple of months ago that we were able to do that. And so this Freedom Suits Memorial is a way to show that even though Dred and Harriet's case is famous, and for a long time, and rightly so, without evidence, a lot of people thought, hey, he's one of three people that might have done that. Well, in all fairness to everyone else, there were other people. Like I said, there was a law that said you could sue for your freedom if you were once free, always free. That was in our area. Other people sued in New York. There are other places that people sued. There's some wonderful stories out there. So I did have the opportunity to share with the audience that, you know, here's a chance for you to be inspired to see, is your ancestor on this monument? You know, other people did. Now, everybody that sued did not get their freedom. And so you might, you know, that there's stories to be told there. But a little under half, maybe 40% of the ones that sued did. Because what you have to have is certain criteria that even allow you to bring your case. You can walk in and say, hey, I want to sue. But you have to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 things in order for them to say, yeah, if it's in order, they'll say, okay. But if it's not, then, you know, you're really wasting your time. But you wouldn't do that normally unless you had the right criteria, because it was very dangerous. You know, you risk suing your master, which in some cases was considered sedition, which is a crazy thing, but that's another story. And so, yes, they were extremely brave. But the real story behind Dred and Harriet's story that makes it different is that when they were told in 1852, on March the 22nd, by the Missouri Supreme Court, that they could not have their freedom after many years of giving freedom to slaves who could prove that they deserved it, they turned their backs on them and the system. They went against precedents and said, no, times are not as they once were when we used to rule on these cases, and we're not going to be doing this so much anymore. And they told them no. So they had gone 6 years and made it to Missouri Supreme Court only to be turned down again, which should not have happened either. They did get their freedom once from 12 white men in a jury at the old courthouse, but it was immediately appealed. Many people don't know that either. So where their case takes off is when they agree to take it to the federal level through Attorney Roswell Field here in St. Louis. And to me, that's where the excessive boldness comes in, because they know now this could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. If it does, it's going to be a ruling that's going to affect everybody. And so for me, between 1852 and 1857, those years were critical. And so, as you know, it didn't go well in the courts, but fortunately, they did get their freedom for all the years that they fought.
And thank you for that additional background regarding the case, because I think people who dig into it, who probably, you know, they're legal scholars or have an interest, may have looked kind of what happened before the, you know, how the road to the Supreme Court, so to speak. But just one last question for you before we close. As it relates to the foundation, you've done some great work so far and honoring Dred and Harriet Scott and the family. Are there any other projects or things that you have coming up besides things you've mentioned to date, or, you know, not even just this year, but into next year, and sort of kind of what do you hope to accomplish with the foundation in the next couple of years as well?
Okay. Yes. The subject we were just on, I want to add a little extra to that. Sure. This year in March, on March 22nd, which we had to do it on the 26th, was an anniversary for Dred Scott's case in Missouri. And over the last 4 years prior to that, I've been asking the Missouri legislature to renounce this 1852 decision, because technically the 14th Amendment did address the Dred Scott decision, for the most part, decision, but what happened in Missouri had never been addressed. So on this March of 2022, we were able to celebrate the fact that last year, in 2021, the legislature did renounce the Dred Scott decision, and there is a full resolution to that effect. And there were groups that prayed for this to happen and for something to happen with the Dred Scott cases. And once it was found out that this actually came to pass, we had an exceptionally awesome celebration at the church where Dred and Harriet went in St. Louis. Harriet's name is on the rolls to be verified. And Central Baptist Church, St. Louis, was also founded on March 22nd, 1846. And my birthday is March 22nd. And I'm the one that gets the honor to do all this great work for them. So we had a wonderful time and just wanted to share that that was something that came from the 1852 case. And virtually 70 years later, our state renounced the decision they made. So the other things that we did, or are doing, I should say, we are having a Dred Scott Reconciliation Conference, which will be October the 29th in St. Louis. And we have a conference every other year. We have Dred Scott Freedom Awards dinner on the opposite years. COVID has thrown those schedules off, but I think we're getting back on track. And the other thing is we now have our own space. It is temporary because we're in Chesterfield Mall in St. Louis, which will be renovated. But until then, we have at least another year and a half and maybe longer to be in this beautiful spot where we this year have started having exhibits. Our first exhibit was one that we put in. Dr. Christy Griffith is a wonderful friend, and she does great work with young people. And she has written a book called Incarcerations in Black and White and dealing with the prison system. So she had our first exhibit there, and it was called Gun Violence, Hope and Peace, where we exhibited artwork and writings of young St. Louis public school students who wrote about their experiences or drew pictures to share their emotions about what it's like to live in a city when you have gunshots going off all the time, or you have lost friends, family members, etc. So that was our first exhibit. It was wonderful. And then we had one on the Black U.S. Marshals, which was set up years ago by a retired Black U.S. Marshal, Robert Moore, out of Springfield, Illinois. We have a Springfield, Missouri, and a Springfield, Illinois. I have to be careful which one it is. And that was really great because people don't know that Frederick Douglass was a U.S. Black Marshal. And this gentleman found out that the only history about them was one sentence in the book on the Marshal's history. And that was outrageous. So he created a book and this exhibit. And so we had that out there. And I'm curating the current one, which will come on September 10th. And it's called Faces of Dred Scott. I'm very excited about it because Faces of Dred Scott is going to have about 30 different renditions of him that people have never seen all at once. I mean, you know, if you live in New York, you might know about this one or whatever. But in my research, I have found these things, or I have my own pictures, or it was something that's just out there that people just haven't seen. So it's going to be a fun collection. Very surprising what some of them will be, but I can't give it away because the opening is next Saturday. And so I'm just inviting everyone that hears this to please come out to and see it. It'll run through September the 30th, and that's a Friday night because a lot's going on Saturday, October 1st. But for 3 weeks, I'll have it there. And then the Circuit Court, where the Freedom Memorial is, they're going to have it in March. So we're doing that. And my goodness, we've got a lot going on, honestly. I'm going to speak at Mizzou, which is University of Missouri in Columbia, one of our premier sites for the university system, on Constitution, not day, but for the Constitution Day. It'll be September 15th. And we'll have all this on our website by tomorrow. But we're just busy, always looking forward. And one day we hope possibly to have an international Dred Scott Education and Reconciliation Center. We don't know for sure when or how. We have looked into this, and so we're looking at it. But that's going to be an incredible thing to have a permanent home. And if that gets pulled off, I feel like I've tied a bow on all of this great work that God's given me to do.
Well, thank you so much. I do appreciate that. And it's, you definitely have a lot going on, and we, you know, people will point folks to the website to get additional information, especially for the upcoming exhibit that's happening on the 10th that goes into the 30th. And then just to learn more about Dred Scott, Dred and Harriet Scott, if they haven't, and the Freedom Suits, as well as the memorials to Dred Scott and more information about him. I really, really appreciate your time today, Lynn, especially the information around the background and the genealogy and the stories that we wouldn't have known had we not been able to talk to you, because the things Thank we haven't you. Seen in books, or maybe something that was written in a book that we don't have our hands on. So I appreciate the kind of insight into the
Can
family.
I give the website too before we go?
Oh, sure you can.
We have two actually. And the first one will give you some of the background about the statue and so forth, but it's the T-H-E, the DredScottFoundation.org was up from 2006 to 2016. And then in March of 2016, we added a website called DredScottLives.org, DredScottLives.org. And between those two, you'll see a rich history of the work that we have done. And we didn't even talk about Sons and Daughters of Reconciliation, so we may have to do this another day.
Yes. Yeah, we will. We'll definitely have you back on the show for sure, on the podcast. And the other thing is that we'll make sure we include those websites as well in the show notes, so people can have listen to it, but they can also have access to it as well. So thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge, and good luck with everything. You'll definitely have to come back and give us an update, and then we can talk more about the other projects and work that you're doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure and great honor. Thank you.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl, and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com. As a reminder, the views expressed by guests on Conversations with Kenyatta are their own and do not reflect the views of Kenyatta D. Berry.